I'm your inner dream monologue, and you're fast asleep, so I'll be quick. Great job using the Colgate Optic White Overnight Teeth Whitening Pen before bed. When used as directed, it gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 7 days. So while I fly and talk to animals, you're removing teeth stains with ease. Sweet dreams. And when you wake up, keep on living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to episode 35 of Literary Disco, A River Runs Through It. Today's episode in two parts. We'll begin with a bookshelf roulette, a segment in which Todd, Julia, and I are forced to find a book at random from our bookshelves and defend our ownership of it. And then we will discuss the novella and the movie A River Runs Through It. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me are essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel and novelist and critic Todd Goldberg. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Good evening, good sir.
I slightly have a cold, so that's why I sound a little off. I'm getting over it, though. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, that was that pause.
Well, Julia had a cold, too, and I didn't see you or I rush to wish her well.
Maybe you caught it through the internet.
I think I did.
I have a friend who got E. coli recently.
Cool.
But that's probably not what you guys want to hear about today on Literary Disco.
I think that's why they listen, to hear about the weather and your friend's digestive problems.
This friend of mine gets a series of diseases that are only, like, brought over on the Mayflower. I won't say this person's name because she's a big fan of the show and is my friend. But she has gotten, in the last couple years, E. coli, pleurisy, rickets, dropsy, like anything that was brought over originally on the Mayflower or was in Jamestown, she has somehow picked up in the last couple years.
I have a friend like that too. She got scarlet fever when we were in college. It was so weird.
That's crazy. So we're going to play some bookshelf roulette. Is that right, Julia?
It is right. And I have numbers.
What are those numbers? Okay. Should you explain, as ever, how this game works for the listening audience?
So how this game works is we get three numbers. First, I log into our Twitter account. Then,
add 2 tablespoons of sugar.
Then, all right, so the first number is a number from 1 to 4, and that's the corner of the bookshelf we're starting on, okay?
Okay.
And that's corner 2. So that's the upper right-hand corner, guys.
Upper right-hand corner,
then,
got it.
Then we are going to count shelves. So we're going to count down from that upper right-hand corner. This time, it's 2. Another 2,
okay.
Everybody. So second shelf from the top. And then we're going to count over from right to left, 12 books. Okay?
All right.
And whatever
very well.
Book you find, that's what we're going to talk about. Finally, we've gotten to my classics bookshelf. Thanks, everybody. Please give that exact same number. Actually, this is very appropriate, and I'll go first. I landed on, for real, Wuthering Heights.
Oh, my. Look at that.
I've read Wuthering Heights at my leisure. I didn't have to read it for school or anything. I'm sure a ton of our listeners have loved it or read it and hated it. Have you guys read Wuthering Heights?
1,000 years ago.
I've never read it, no. You love it, right?
You know, I love it, but I love Jane Eyre a lot more, mostly because I've read Jane Eyre 4 times. I've read Wuthering Heights once, so I haven't, it doesn't
You kind of
stick.
Love that whole, like, Victorian novel.
Goodness.
I've never been able to get into those kinds of books for some reason. Like, I mean,
yeah.
even like Jane Austen, I recently rediscovered and realized, like, I actually really like, but mm-hmm. I used to hate her when I was in college.
There's a big Austen versus Bronte divide. So I have never really loved Jane Austen, actually. I mean, I like Emma.
Really?
But Jane Austen's novels are much more social, and the Brontes...
Do you think she's too proud or too prejudiced?
I think she has...
She has some sense.
Too much... Ah, damn it! But the Brontes are... they're actually a lot more like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, or that style that I really like. They all take place on moors and people die of horrible things.
That's exactly why I never got into it. It's like that weird, like, I don't know. It's a maze to me. Like, it's a maze of language and character that I've never quite just gotten.
It's a thicket.
And then there's a whole issue of manners that comes along.
It's
in
too
it
proper.
Too.
That's what it comes down to. It's just, it's too, it feels inhuman to me. It feels removed. It, like, it never gets into that, like, messy human stuff.
Well, that's
that
untrue. So that's conflating Austen, Jane Austen, and the Bronte sisters. So Jane Austen, that's what you're describing. But the Brontes get dark and very strange. And it's very difficult to talk about Jane Eyre without revealing the huge, 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 huge spoiler in the book, which is a huge part of the reason that it's so popular. But that spoiler is really, really messed up and very human, and it requires Jane to kind of rethink. It's a twist on the classic Victorian novel, is that one of the characters has been hiding this secret that just completely blows apart the idea that a young governess can, you know, move into a manor and fall in love and everything will work out perfectly. That does not happen in Bronte novels. And in Wuthering Heights, it's the same thing. I mean, there's a burning, torturous romance in the middle of it, but something happens.
And a house that's shaped like a skull, you know? I mean, isn't that the opening paragraph describes the house and it looks like basically a dead face or something like that?
Or are you confusing it with the fall of the House of Usher?
It's a very foreboding opening that describes the house in Wuthering Heights.
No. All right, here it is. 1801. I have just returned from a visit to my landlord, the solitary neighbor that I shall be troubled with. This is certainly a beautiful country. In all England, I do not believe that I could have fixed on a situation so completely removed from the stir of society. A perfect misanthropist heaven. And Mr. Heathcliff and I are such a suitable pair to divide the desolation between us. A capital fellow. He little imagined how my heart warmed toward him when I beheld his black eyes withdraw so suspiciously under their brows as I rode up, and when his fingers sheltered themselves with a jealous resolution still further in his waistcoat as I announced my name.
I'm sorry.
Shut up.
Were you? Because oh God, this is weird.
Yeah,
because
the second I heard
I fell
the word misanthropes,
I fell asleep. So my body thought I was asleep. So this is weird.
Oh,
I hope you guys can see this. I hope. Wow.
It's all that wordiness that the Victorian, like Edith Wharton, I don't like that much either. I need to. I mean, I should invest the time it takes.
But you like Poe, right? And Poe is obviously
They're short stories.
The thing is, you know, you have to sink into it. You have to, you know, it's like swimming. You have to get all the way into the mood. And when you hear what the words are really saying, you know, is that I was attracted to this man because he hated everything and was retreating into his waistcoat and is dark and brooding and horrible. You know, that is, it's an interesting thought. You just have to dig. You have to dig deep. It's not a book you can read lightly.
Right. It's not like a Middlesex that you can just sort of zip right through it.
Yeah,
I mean,
no.
It's
not like
you gotta spend some time on it.
Finnegan's Wake, which you would commit to reading a couple pages at a time. You know, it's not like that. It's not an easy book writer.
It's
that
not.
You like.
It's not as Graham. It's not as Graham Greene would call it entertainment. It's actual literature.
So yeah, Wuthering Heights. That's what I landed on.
I also landed on a classic.
Ooh.
And it's a classic that this particular book has history. The actual physical copy. Ooh. I landed on Dickens' Great Expectations.
I love that book.
Me too.
Absolutely love that book. One of my top five favorites of all time.
This is from the Occidental College Library. You can actually see it bound at the Occidental College Library. I got charged $400 for this book.
You did not.
Because I checked this book out, lost it, got a bill. I couldn't believe that if you lose a library book, they charge you at the student library $400 for a book that I could get for a dollar at the thrift, you know, the Dover thrift edition. I could print it for, you know, 50 cents or whatever. But the fact that I was billed for this fucking book, and then about 4 years ago, an old friend from college stopped by a party at my parents' house, and he handed this book to me. I
left
it in his dorm room our first year in college, and he had never thought like anything of it. And then he realized, oh, this is Ryder had checked this copy out. So he brought it to a party, and I got this book back, and I was like, you son of a bitch, you cost me $400 because you didn't return this book to me, you know, when we were 17. So, yeah.
Wait,
and neither of us stayed at auction
house
either.
He
transferred out after
a year.
I must have left it in his room because I don't think he ever read it because he said, yeah, I never read it. So I must have left it in his room. Or
he never even read
it? No, he hadn't even read it in all that time. And I hadn't even finished it because I had, you know, gotten halfway through it or whatever. So I'm not a huge Dickens fan. We've talked about this before, Todd, because Todd's a huge fan of this book.
I love that book. I think it's one of the most remarkable pieces of literature ever written.
I agree.
And it's influenced so many other books. There's no Great Gatsby. There's no Great Gatsby without Great Expectations.
Did you guys know that Mark Twain's first date with his wife was to go see Charles Dickens do a reading?
No.
I thought he went and saw Val Kilmer as Charles Dickens.
Perfect selection of Val Kilmer, by the way.
Know about this?
No, what?
Oh, God.
Val Kilmer is the new Mark Twain because the dude who's playing Mark Twain eventually is going to die. Hal Holbrook, is that who plays Mark Twain?
Yes, his name is Hal Holbrook, and he's incredible. Hal Holbrook has been... This is an amazing
look,
fact.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you can see the look on Ryder's face...
Val Kilmer? Why Val Kilmer?
That's the question the world wants to know. Why Val Kilmer?
Hal Holbrook is incredible. He's actually literally been playing Mark Twain longer than Mark Twain played Mark Twain. He started when he was in his 20s, and now he's in his 80s. And so he used to have to age up, and now he has to age down. It's amazing. And he's very talented, and it's his life's work, and he's a true Twain
scholar.
And then
Val Kilmer wants to take that big money of playing Mark Twain for himself.
He works in Batman references.
No, he
does. Yes, he does.
No.
Yes, he does.
No.
What does he do? I don't understand.
I'll send you a video. Yeah. So anyway, Val Kilmer is Dickens. It could work. I could see it.
I can't see it. Well, in the similar vein, I too have pulled out a classic.
Oh my God. This is like, for me, this is like pulling the triple cherry at a casino.
Except my classic is a little bit different. My classic is a classic issue of the literary magazine Barrel House. from 2009. Barrel House, our friends at Barrel House, we did a little episode of their podcast when we were at AWP with
book
them.
Book fight.
Book fight! So this is an old issue. This is issue 7 from 2009. I've never read it, but I own it. And there is there's some really good stuff in here. There's something I'm going to point out directly, but there's a great story. I'm presuming it's great because it's a wonderful writer by Matt Bell called Beauty Forever. There is a short story called The Truth About Ninjas by Alex Irvine. There's a bunch of poetry. And then there's also an illustrated story. So what they used to do, and I don't know if they still do it, is they would have an artist illustrate a story that had appeared on their website. And this issue, the story was called Bigfoot's Widow by a writer named Joni Tevis. And so they've turned into a little graphic comic about Bigfoot's widow. And
I want to read that.
Looks very amusing. Barrel House, for those of you who don't know, it's a literary magazine out of Washington, D.C., or Bethesda, perhaps. Maybe that's what it is. But they've been around for a couple years. They used to always have a feature in every issue, an interview with someone where they'd ask them what their favorite Patrick Swayze movie was. And sometimes the people being interviewed would be like, why the fuck are you asking me that? But most of the time, they'd get a really strongly considered answer. Like, you know, well, if it has to be my favorite actual movie, it'd probably be Dirty Dancing.
Yeah.
But my favorite role that Patrick Swayze played, it would absolutely have to be, you know, Next of Kin or Roadhouse. And I had a piece in Barrel House a couple years ago, a short story called Walls that was in one of my books. And when they interviewed me, I had to really think about the question. And, you know, my feeling is that he was never better, Patrick Swayze, than when he was in Point Break as Bodhi.
Mm.
But for sheer entertainment value alone, I got to go Outsiders or Red Dawn. Was he in Outsiders? He was in Red Dawn for sure.
I don't see how anything other than Dirty Dancing is the correct answer.
Red Dawn is the correct answer because
Ghost, guys, we haven't talked about Ghost.
No, Ghost is horrible. Okay. I don't cotton to Ghost.
I think
the
Ghost
red shirt
is great, but Dirty Dancing is, I mean, talk about a classic.
Well, the problem with Ghost also is that I saw that movie on a date with a girl named Holly when I was in college, and then long story short, I was dating her roommate, and she ended up pouring acid on the hood of my Toyota Tercel. So I sort of have an atavastic...
Serious?
Yes. I sort of have an atavastic response
That's
to the Ghost because...
That's not a problem with Ghost. That's a problem with you. And a problem with Holly.
Where does one find acid?
I don't know. And she was like...
how do you procure acid to pour?
I don't know what it was, but she was like...
That would freak me out, man. That's like a violent move.
She wasn't... like, I'm not Facebook friends with her, so...
Was it really bad, or was it like,
it was like a big circle on the hood of the car, and I don't know, like, was she trying to write something? But then she was pretty upfront with the fact of, did you like what I did to your car? And I'm like, you put a, like, an O on my car? What does that mean?
It's probably some voodoo thing, and it hasn't come through yet.
Yeah, she cursed you, dude.
When you get ringworm, you're going to think about her.
But anyway, Barrel House is a lovely literary magazine. You should all pick up a copy of it at your local independent bookstore where it's surely sold. They have a very active web presence at barrelhouse.com. And they just started a book press also. So they're putting out books soon. And their editors are lovely. Dave Housley had a great book called Ryan Seacrest is Famous that I really liked a couple years ago. So that's my... that's my roulette. And I'll put up a link to Barrel House since I'm sure some folks on our Facebook will never have heard of them. So that's my classic.
Classics all around.
I don't know if Barrel House counts as a classic.
Yeah, but Dirty Dancing does. That's a truly subversive movie.
The time of my life. And I owe it all to you. Bum, 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 bum. One time, right after my wife, Wendy, and I graduated college, we went to a wedding that a friend of hers had, and the groom and the bride had a whole dance thing to that song that they did on the dance floor by themselves.
That's did he lift her in the air?
He did the whole kit and caboodle, and I was like, wow. And they were not small people, so that made it even more of a challenge.
Saying that you watched a fat reenactment of Dirty Dancing.
I'll tell you, it wasn't like that scene in Crazy Stupid Love with Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone. It was not quite the athleticism.
I want to see Val Kilmer and Hal Holbrook do that.
Oh, that, I think they could absolutely do that.
Welcome back to Literary Disco. We're going to talk about two things now. We're going to talk about Norm MacLean's novella, A River Runs Through It, which was originally published in 1976 as part of a collection, River Runs Through It and Other Stories. And then we're going to talk about the Robert Redford 1992 film adaptation. I think it was 92. Was it 93?
Somewhere I think it was 92.
Which we've all recently revisited because... I had seen it back then, but I didn't really remember anything about it. I had recently been given A River Runs Through It, the book, by a friend of mine, and he said I had to read it because he found out I had never read it. Mostly I hadn't read it because I had bad memories of the movie. I remember not liking the movie that much. And so I started reading this story, and I love it so much, and I immediately... felt like Norman MacLean was just a genius. So I thought we should talk about it on the podcast. So what'd you guys think?
Yeah. We should probably all say our status of how we came to it. Like you, I had never seen the movie or read the book. Mm. So I read the book first and then I watched the movie this afternoon.
Yeah.
How about you, Todd?
I originally read the short story or the novella college. I think it was probably my junior year of college.
In a writing class or?
Yeah. In 1990, 1991. And then I immediately ran to the theater and saw it, and we'll talk about that experience shortly. Like it was given to me in a class where we were reading Tobias Wolff, Richard Ford, Carver.
God.
So it was that
it makes
whole,
sense. They're in that era.
That
yeah.
whole sort of lineage of American writers writing about, the West or the Middle West, basically,
right.
And nature. Because, this book really, or this story really is a great harbinger for a lot of those men and geese, men and fish, men and whatever in Colorado that goes on, or Missouri, that you really saw throughout the 1980s. So that is part of that class, and I absolutely loved this book. I hadn't read it subsequently in many years, and so going back to it now was great. I mean, I absolutely love this, and I've read the rest of the book that this is in, and there's some great nonfiction work about him fighting fires also that is pretty amazing stuff that I haven't read also in years, but when I did read it, I was like, oh my God, this is absolutely amazing stuff. So I have been familiar with this for a very long time and have loved it for a very long time, and I was happy to read it and still absolutely love it. And then also happy to watch the movie again and realize exactly why I didn't like the movie.
Yeah.
but we can get to that.
Well, yeah, let's get to that later. Well, guys, I didn't like this book. Just kidding, I fucking loved it. Crying my eyes.
I didn't like it because it was stupid. It reminded me of what I wrote when I was 12.
I think this is one of those books.
Is that your impression of me?
Why does that sound like something you'd say?
You know, when you read a book like this, I felt within a paragraph, you know, it's one of those books, if you are a writer or if you're a reader who loves good writing, there's absolutely, it's not debatable to me. No. This is a great piece of writing. Mm-hmm. The writing itself is out of this world. Good, it's calm, it's detailed.
It's so confident.
It's complex. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a steady hand. Well, we should talk about a little bit what the story is, because there actually isn't that much story.
No, it's pretty
which is part
plotless.
Of the reason why I think the movie is pretty horrible, because it tries to make a story where there isn't one. So basically, it's it's him himself, right? Norman McLean as
Norman
a character.
McLean.
So it's very autobiographical, but it's definitely considered fiction. So he categorized it as such, but he must have grown up fly fishing, because it's using fly fishing and his relationship with this sport and this activity and his relationship with his brother and his brother-in-law. But it's really kind of a fragmentary, you know, he talks about the relationship with his father, but it's mostly is just about them going fishing, and there's drama that seems to be occurring, but it's kind of outside of the purview of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Between, you know, his brother-in-law, you know, you just get the feeling, you don't really know why, but his brother-in-law is just a dick. He's kind of a fuck-up. His wife asks him and his brother to take her brother fishing to sort of straighten him out or to help him out. And then Paul, you get the sense that Paul, the brother, is in trouble. But that never really takes center of stage in the action. Mostly what the story is concerned with are these fishing trips, about three or four specific fishing trips. And he's just kind of philosophizes while he's fishing or... I mean, it's hard to say, like, what's exactly happening.
It's a story that is built entirely on subtext, and the subtext is obvious. And he says the subtext is obvious, that the words are beneath the water, basically. Right. And so all the relationships that are happening in this story, people don't say what they feel to each other, even to brothers. And so everything is then, the only way that they can deal with their particular conflicts is to deal with them while they are fishing, by the way that they each fish. And I think this is, it's a fascinating thing to me, and I wish I had known it when I was reading it when I was younger, but that the way each person fishes in this is an outlet of their personality. Right. And, you know, it you see this a lot, I think, in films now, particularly, where the way someone drives or the way someone has sex or the way someone fights is emblematic of a larger character issue. But it's done so elegantly here, where it could be really on the nose. And then, I mean, there are some spots where you could say that Norman McLean was being on the nose, but I think it's so poetically written that you overlook the, you know, the heavy-handedness of the metaphor of fishing and life, because he admits what it is right away, you know? And so that, it's really compelling in that way.
There's two things about the subject matter of this book that I love a lot, and I'm sure we'll get into both of them, but one is this book has... that absolute pleasure of reading about something that, you know, 99% of people know absolutely nothing about, and explaining it in such a compelling and elegant way that I now feel that I could read about fly fishing forever, mm-hmm. you know, and that it that is built with meaning inherently. And, you know, there's other great books like that that I love. Like, I think we all like, Tom Lynch's The Undertaking, which is, essays about being an undertaker in a small town. Catherine Dunn's book on boxing, which is the same. We've talked about that before, and it's just got that, you know, sense to it of, oh my God, there's this sport, or there's this subculture, or there's this hobby that people are doing all around me all the time that is just loaded and loaded and loaded with meaning and detail and beauty, which is a word that he uses himself quite a lot.
Which his father uses a lot, too, to describe things. And that's a great moment where he realizes that his father says someone is beautiful. At the end of the book, he calls his brother Paul. The father calls his son Paul, but the narrator's brother Paul, beautiful. And it's, you know, men don't typically, I think, express themselves very well emotionally, generally speaking, but to specifically note the beauty of another man, you know, it takes a lot of confidence that you can speak like that and you don't give a shit what someone else thinks of the male point of view saying something else is pretty. It's really a powerful moment in the book and throughout the book.
Well, I think the masculinity of this book, to get back to our conversation from Ron Curry Jr., is something that I really loved. It felt really sincere. Yeah. It feels like a very masculine book, not in a defensive way, in a way where you could see how someone would be the most graceful fly fisherman and also a street fighter, you know, at the same time, that a man would hold both of those as aspects of his masculinity. I and the relationship between brothers felt very real. It's like, well, we never, what is it? They use the line in the movie too. It's like, we never determined who was more tough, or there was one opportunity to determine who was more tough. And once we touched that, we never revisited again. Yeah. And all of those discussions of toughness and masculinity, I don't know, they just rang so true and yet so sensitive at the same time.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of this book is about emotional repression, or, you know, or inability to talk about your emotions, or and how men use an activity like fishing to bond and to help each other. You know, and I love that the use of the word help. Mm-hmm. Like, when his brother is in trouble, he has to pick his brother up drunk. He feels like taking him fishing is helping him. Mm-hmm. And he's not even sure what that means, you know, but it's like all he knows to do is to either offer money or take somebody fishing. And I just thought, I love that because it spoke volumes about our narrator without us needing to know any of the details about his own life, really. The what is undiscussed, you know, you hear about these problems in people's lives, and you get these vague senses of, oh, they're seeing a prostitute now, oh, they're drinking too much, they're getting in trouble with the law, but you never get to talk about those details because these male characters never talk to each other on that level. They never open up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's a respect for that our narrator, you know, Norman McLean as a character, is respectful of his characters in a way because his narrator is also unwilling to divulge details. Or to me, it realizes a lot of, like, I'm not a huge Hemingway fan, but I really like Hemingway's early short stories, and I really like a lot of the ideas that Hemingway had about writing. And I look at a book like this, and I think it's a better version of what Hemingway was trying to do. Like, to me, this is way more interesting and philosophical, and does a lot of the things that I think he wanted to do with a sport, you know, like sports writing or an activity and masculinity. And I don't know.
But there's also the fact that you are aware that Norman is writing his novel or writing this story. And then also Paul's a journalist. So they both are in the word business, but there's a small paragraph in the middle of this where they're fishing, as happens, and he says, as the heat mirages on the river in front of me danced with and through each other, I could feel patterns from my own life joining with them. It was here, while waiting for my brother, that I started this story. Although, of course, at the time I did not know that stories of life are often more like rivers than books, but I knew a story had begun, perhaps long ago near the sound of water. And I sensed that ahead I would meet something that would never erode, so there would be a sharp turn, deep circles, a deposit, and quietness. So it's that revelation that as that moment is happening, he is also storing it to write about it, that I think is a really unusual narrative trick that's in here, but it also gives you the ability to look at this man as a more sensitive person than he is actually outwardly being towards his brother.
Exactly.
Which I think is very interesting.
Which is why it fails as a movie, right? I mean, because when you why would you ever think that you could make a movie out of this story? Like, that part I just don't understand.
When I started reading it, I was like, I have absolutely no concept of how they're going to make this into a movie, because one thing that I love about this book also is its sense of time is totally warped. Yep. It is not told in a linear way at all. It's referring to different points of their lives all throughout. It's not even, you know, you can't even say it's one of those novels that's bookended. It's not a flashback. It's not anything. It's pieces of their lives constructing an emotional narrative, not a narrative.
Right.
So when I started the movie, I was shocked, actually. I was shocked by the fact that how he met, you know, his wife was in any way important. Because it isn't.
No.
You know, it has nothing to
do
with
anything. They put a love story into it, basically. Right. But see, here's the thing, though, is that this, plot-wise, this is a story that is constantly about the aftermath of confrontation. Because each scene is them going fishing to work out the issues that have already happened. Well, you can't make a movie about the aftermath of conflict unless it's the day after tomorrow and it's just, there's been a nuclear war. And now you're walking through. So they had to they had to make it linear, and they had to put in a love story, and they had to, you know, make the Paul character's problems, that this is no spoiler for those of you who have seen the movie or will read the book, and it's not a spoiler really when you read it. Paul ends up dying at the end. But they had to make the reasons for his death the centerpiece of the conflict of the story, when it doesn't really matter. You know, this is he's a romantic figure. He's going to die. So, you know, but you can't just have a 30-minute movie and say, and he's going to die because he's played by Brad Pitt and he's horribly romantic in this. You just can't do it.
Well, I mean, for me, Ryder already said this, but so I said there were two things that I loved about this. And the second thing is this question of how do you help someone? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have been having that question in my own life lately of, you know, I have a friend who had a relative who committed suicide, and, you know, obviously that's a huge part of this. And then I have another friend who's very depressed, and it's a burning, heavy question of what is help? How do we help? Right. And that's the tension and that's the arc, because you can see, you know, that there are millions and millions of reasons why someone like that would die an untimely death. And, you know, when it happened, you know, it could have been so many different ways that would have been believable in the narrative, because the character was so well drawn in that way. You know, you just know that someone is living on the edge like that and could die. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there aren't enough books that truly hit that question in the emotional way that this did. I mean, you know what this book is? You know what crossed my mind? This book is the adult Bridge to Terabithia.
Oh my God. Yes. Really? It totally
it's the
is.
Same,
I've never read Bridge to Terabithia.
Oh my God.
It's the
I cried in my third grade class when it was read aloud. I was a fucking idiot.
What is it about?
It's about two children who, a boy and a girl, and I think they have conflict as well.
Yes.
And they, but they have an imaginary world in the woods.
That they build a bridge from across a small river.
And they have difficult lives for some reason. I can't remember, because the Terabithia parts are so similar to the fly fishing parts. As they go and they, you know, they're in the woods, they're in the trees. And then, as anyone who's read it knows, one of them dies, and it's this feeling of, you know, the end of childhood, but also the end of this romantic place that they have built, and that place can never be returned to.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So if you like Bridge to Terabithia and you're an adult who loves to read, you will absolutely love A River Runs Through It. It's very similar.
Well, and I think there's also and this is hard to convey in the movie specifically, is the philosophy and the religion that is embedded in them in the fishing as well. It is not just a cathartic experience. It is a spiritual experience for them also. And it's part of their father is a preacher, but he's as interested in God as he is in fishing, and he's also having his own conflicts. You know, he now doesn't believe that God created the earth in 6 days. He's willing to say half a billion years ago, but not a billion years ago. So there's all sorts of unsaid things about faith as well. Faith that the fish will be there. Faith that if you do this correctly, you'll have a good response from it. I mean, these guys, as fishermen, are otherworldly. I mean, these guys they catch giant fish and they do it with a miraculous ease. And I'm sure some of you listening are fishermen or fisherwomen or fisher people. Catching fish it's all about patience and being willing to go home with absolutely nothing. But these guys are extraordinarily successful at it. And so there's God in the water as well, which I think, I mean, in the film, the cinematography is beautiful, actually. And I think it was nominated for an Academy Award for cinematography. And so you get the sense of majesty, but you don't get the words that the writer has written in the book to really give it more importance than just a pretty picture.
I there was this really cool narrative voice that he has that I noticed. You know, it's this, I don't know, is it aphorism is the right word? It's like making these bold general statements, but they're very specific. And just found out his brother, he just picked his brother up and his brother's been drinking and owes people money. And so then he goes on a drive at sunrise by himself and has, sunrise is the time to feel that you will be able to find out how to help somebody close to you who you think needs help, even if he doesn't think so. At sunrise, everything is luminous, but not clear.
I underlined that too.
That is so brilliant. I mean, there's so many passages like that where he's making such a general philosophical statement that is clearly linked to the immediate situation that he's in, and both work. Do you know what I mean? Like the general philosophical statement is awesome and cool, and that then also it tells you the whole story between his.
He's being both prophetic and philosophical.
Exactly.
Which is an interesting combination.
All right. Here's the reason I think that works. I think that those statements work because he's not using, there's no feeling that he's like being all writerly and using those, he's not using fishing to be philosophical. He really believes that fishing is a philosophical activity.
Yes.
And that's a huge distinction. So here's what I wanted to read, which goes perfectly with what you're saying. And with the religious aspects that Todd was pointing out. The body and spirit suffer no more sudden visitation than that of losing a big fish, since, after all, there must be some slight transition between life and death. But with a big fish, one moment the world is nuclear, and the next it has disappeared. That's all. It has gone. The fish is gone, and you are extinct, except for 4.5 ounces of stick to which is tied some line, and a semi-transparent thread of catgut to which is tied a little curved piece of Swedish steel to which is tied a part of a feather from a chicken's neck.
Mm. Yeah, I love that passage.
Man, I love that. That's beautiful.
It's everything. It's the tiniest detail of a piece of a chicken's, you know, that's... It's the whole package. It's, oh my God, that's what fly fisherman shit is made out of, and oh, life, death, and God.
So how is he able to be filled with profundity where other people writing about the same thing would sound like they are just spouting, you know, aphorisms, as writer said? I mean, those aren't aphorisms. Like, what he's saying is, it's like insight into the human spirit or into the way the world works.
I felt like it really came full circle near the end when he's having a conversation with his father, who's a preacher, and he's describing his father, and he said, he tried to tell me. He spoke in the abstract, but he had spent his life fitting abstractions to listeners so that listeners would have no trouble fitting his abstractions to the particulars of their lives. And I thought in a way that relates very much to the way Norman of Acclaim is writing the story. It's like that balance between big abstract ideas that he believes in and a very specific story and a very specific family. And I work so well in the story. Why anyone would think that you could lift some of them out and have a voiceover, Robert Redford reading them as a voiceover, and maintain their profundity is ridiculous. Like they become cheesy.
Like, except for at the end. At the end of the movie. So if you people don't want to watch the movie, just get on YouTube and watch the last 3 minutes of A River Runs Through It, and you'll get the entire book, the entire film. That last moment in the movie where he's in voiceover and he reads the last paragraph of the book itself, And it's the older version of himself. It's Norman McLean is out fishing. It is extraordinarily moving, and he does it extraordinarily well because he's Robert Redford, and he sounds great, and the words are good. But everything else, I mean, I have a big problem, generally speaking, with voiceover in films because typically I think you see it more often in adaptations because they don't necessarily know how to get as close to the work as the work itself. So I find the movie of A River Runs Through It really cold and impersonal.
I agree.
And the voiceover clearly is there to try to mitigate that problem, but it just doesn't work. I mean, it's just, it looks beautiful, but it doesn't have that emotion. But then, you know, this week I also saw Goodfellas, the Martin Scorsese movie, and I just read...
It's a great voiceover.
It's a great voiceover.
Perfect use of voiceover, yeah.
And I just read the book Wise Guy that the movie is based upon, and it's an absolute perfect use because that entire film basically is a montage. It doesn't have the normal scene structure, and so you need that voiceover to connect it. And the voiceover itself is character. So the character of Henry Hill or his wife in the movie, they come through in the voiceover and are characters themselves, and that changes the whole scope of it. Or even Casino, which is another Martin Scorsese gangster film that I also watched recently, both based on books. So, you know, it's, I think that's the real challenge of deciding you're going to adapt a book like this is, how do you get that emotional flavor without taking directly from the book the narrative flourishes of the writer? And I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you can adapt this.
And for the opposite, this has just been on my mind. So I've been watching Orange is the New Black on Netflix, mm-hmm. Which is great, and it's funny, and it has a huge variety of characters. And that's adapted from a memoir, and I looked at it. You know, I was about to buy it, and then I was like, no, I think this book is terrible. I just can tell that the fact that it's told from a memoir point of view means it doesn't have the richness and the insight that the show is able to do. Right. So also knowing when to remove a voiceover aspect, yes. You know, to really consider what the point of view is adding or taking away from the story is... You know, it's so important. And A River Runs Through It just felt like shortcut, nostalgic cheating.
Exactly.
Like, I was so upset. I was so upset that the movie felt nostalgic because this book does not feel nostalgic. It feels desperate and sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
but so what about this comparison? So the book version and the movie version of Shawshank Redemption, which I know you just saw, Julia, has mm-hmm. Red's voiceover as a thread throughout the entire movie as well. How'd you like the voiceover in that?
I like it. I think it's that's such a direct adaptation mm-hmm. that it feels. Stephen King is a tough example because he writes very cinematically.
I was going to say, yeah, his stuff becomes visual stories so easy. I mean, you're talking about a guy trying to escape from prison.
Right.
His background as an artist is he loved movies before he loved books, so that's a different situation. You know, like this book is, you know, you can tell that Stephen King's got a very cinematic point of view at all times. He can't help it. Whereas this, A River Runs Through It, actually reminded me of other unadaptable books like Gilead, mm-hmm. amazing book, similar subject, spiritual subject matter.
Yeah.
You know, it's not written cinematically at all.
No.
It's deep within the head of the character. Right. Whereas, you know, The Shawshank Redemption, that's
it's a plot-driven
it feels
book.
More like a
yeah.
narrative device of, you know, to maintain this mystery of what's really going on behind that Rita Hayworth poster. Okay.
Adaptation we should note is that they really, I mean, we've talked about this a bit, is that they really changed the story quite a bit. So in the book itself,
Well, they added a story. They've made it a story.
Yeah, they made a story.
Basically, they created one out of thin air, which doesn't work. It's
no.
just a bad story.
Norman in the book has already married... and it, you know, he's come back from being in the Forest Service. The book takes place, I think, at a significant time removed from where the movie does. This isn't the movie starts. He hasn't even been in the Forest Service yet, right?
Yeah, the movie does. They're kids.
Yeah.
It's like a coming of age story for the first like
right.
hour,
right?
And then it becomes a love story, and then they've weaved basically the two. There's only like two plot lines in the short story. There's really the brother-in-law storyline and then his brother.
Right.
And they're not much, and what all the action of those plots is outside of the story. So you're just, like you were saying, Todd, it's all about the aftermath of going fishing after you've had the confrontation or whatever. And That's why I don't understand why they thought they could make this into a movie. I mean, I guess I feel like after watching the movie, they just obviously Robert Redford wanted to shoot people fly fishing. Like that is a beautiful thing to watch. Like somebody fly fishing.
The movie's gorgeous. Yeah.
It's visually, that is a wonderful thing. But then outside of that, like all the other decisions, it started to feel like a pageant, like a Norman mm-hmm. Rockwell. Like, let's dress up in costume. And there was a moment where they had, like, they do this shot where they're panning left to right a row of children eating watermelon.
Yes.
And I was like, ugh, this is so... He literally looked at a Norman Rockwell pic. Because what kids sit in a row and eat a giant piece of watermelon, like, perfect? It was, like, so clearly, like, what does 1926 look like? And then they had, like, this really cheesy Norman Rockwell image of three kids in a row eating watermelon, like, a giant smile. And he does that shot. And I was like, that is... It's, like, the most astounding visual cliche to show a picnic. And it was that kind of stuff kept happening throughout the film. It was just really clunky filmmaking.
But how about how adorable young Joseph Gordon-Levitt was?
OMG. I lost my shit right away.
I was like, oh my god, that's Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah. Huh.
That was a surprise.
But I noticed, because I was aware of the voiceover, and I love Joseph Gordon-Levitt, that what was really clunky is that it was basically just voiceover for mm-hmm. that entire part. It's just kids looking adorably at
for like 30 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dancing and for the hookers.
They don't, it's essentially what I felt is they didn't figure out how to turn this prose into dialogue. They couldn't do it. They tried and they decided it was too hard. Exactly. That is actually what it felt like.
Well, and the thing that they dramatized their childhood makes absolutely no sense, because he doesn't even dramatize it in the book. He basically just says, you know, we were rough and tumble kids who learned to love the land or whatever.
But it just felt so pointless of, like, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is running 3 feet in front of his brother and the mom's like, wait for your brother. And then the little kid runs like 6 inches forward. And it's like, they weren't even that far apart. You know? Like, what the hell?
What kind of parenting is that? Let kids be kids.
Scene by scene, I couldn't figure out what was going on. Like, I'm literally looking at... They keep having these brother scenes, you know, mm-hmm. when they're kids, and then as they're adults. And I don't know what the relationship is supposed to be. Like, I really don't. I'm like, did Brad Pitt make any decisions? Did anybody decide what they're talking about? Because they have, like, these looks, and they'll be like, we'll go fishing tomorrow. I'll be like, yeah, fishing. And you're like, so?
It was kind of incredible how it took the venom out of things that felt high stakes mm-hmm. in the story.
Yep.
Like the racial tensions mm-hmm. with the Native American. It just felt like, look at this scene. Or I thought, it's funny because I feel like a lot of the tension that I got out of the novella was this tension of trying to please his wife and his mother-in-law, basically trying to do right by them. Like, there's real love there. And so that every time, you know, his brother-in-law, you know, sunburns his ass, that there's real stakes right. in that. Like, it doesn't seem like a yonk, yonk, yonk.
Because there's a part in the book where he even says, my brother must think that this is going to end my marriage, because they bring back the brother-in-law all burnt, and it's like an entire house of women is yelling at him. And he has that moment where he suddenly is no longer the person that protects. He's the person that needs protection from the situation. It's a very, I mean, it's just, it's a paragraph in the book, but it's a really important development in Norman's character, because he begins to understand what being a part of two families is about. And about mm-hmm. the value mm-hmm. of love between siblings and the value of love between you and the person you're married to. Yeah. All of which is completely lost because they aren't married in the movie. It's a love story in the movie.
And they can't believe they actually lifted the dialogue, because the moment that you're talking about is like some of the greatest dialogue in the story, where she says, you're funny.
Yes.
You don't like my brother. And he says, I don't.
I do not like your brother.
I do not like your brother. Yes. And it's, but he, then he follows it up with another, it's a beautiful little passage, but it's, it says everything about this relationship. Because really, he doesn't talk much about his wife, but you know that they have this deep and abiding love that, has this conflict in it, but they're going to figure it out and they're going to make it through. Mm-hmm. And then he has like this devastating line mm-hmm. where he said, like, I told her I would love her forever. And I do, her death got in the way of that or something. Yeah, it's so effective. And then they take that dialogue that precedes that amazing line and plug it into like this romantic comedy moment of the movie.
And then Brad Pitt jumps in.
And then Brad Pitt jumps in for no reason. And it's like a sunset. We tried to make it pretty to make sense of why this is a meaningful.
Oh, it's a horrible scene.
It's just bad. It's just bad, bad, bad directing.
You know what, guys? If you make me watch one more fucking movie that begins with an old man's hand saying, like, I had to write this, blah, 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 I'm going to quit this podcast. It's my pet peeve. I can't take it anymore. I don't want to watch any more movies about someone writing the movie that they're about to be in. I don't want to watch that. Can we make a law? Can I lobby Congress? I hate it.
Tell me your backstory, wise author.
Because I think this is what I said before, but I am a writer. I love being a writer. But people other than writers can have ideas and tell stories.
Yes, that's true.
That is what annoys me about it. You don't get credit because you're a writer. It's not like, it's so frustrating.
Well, here's a mental exercise, though. So I just read Wild. I just finished Wild by Cheryl Strayed, which mm-hmm. we talked about before. And apparently, you know, that's going to be adapted by Reese Witherspoon,
yeah.
Whatever is going to play it. How do you translate that? Because that is, to me, you would have, the fact that she's a writer is so essential to that story. And yet, it, obviously it has this big externalized mission, you know, she's hiking. But I don't know how you're going to convert that into a movie. Like, that would be really difficult. And I imagine if I
Nick Hornby's writing the script.
Better be good.
Yeah, I mean, how are you going to... Are you going to have voiceover in that case? Or
Yes, I think it'll have to have voiceover. But there's huge drama in that book. You know, the hike, all the stuff with her background growing up poor, and the horse, things I don't want to ruin, things that I love. You know, the fact that someone wrote it eventually, I think... I mean,
but see, to me, everything that you just described about that, like those backstories, become Lifetime movies in my mind. Like, if I actually like the story, what actually happens is very. I mean, that's her whole thing. Is like she's making a ritual out of nothing. You know, mm-hmm. she's creating a ritual, and what saves what otherwise would be a very cheesy story to me is her writing. Like, it's the prose and her character as a person, and that doesn't come across. Like, that's going to be so hard to get across on in a movie without. Becoming cheesy and
well, I think it's hard, but that's the challenge, and that's why so many movies are bad.
Right.
And I'm not saying that
true.
You know, things shouldn't be well written. I'm saying that it should not begin with her writing in her journal. It, you know what I mean? The fact that she's a writer doesn't automatically make the writing good. You know?
Let me ask you guys a question that's sort of related to Cheryl Strayed's book. There was an essay in the LA Review of Books 2 days ago. That about nature writing, and it basically said, and I disagree mm-hmm. with this, even though I have not read the book, I disagree with its premise, that Wilde had ruined nature writing, and that what? Nature writing had to get back to, you know, the writing of John Muir and stuff. I'll put the link up on our Facebook as well. But I had just read that, and then I reread this book right after that, and I was thinking about this book in terms of nature writing itself. And how, you know, it is really a story of man versus nature. And it's man versus the actual nature, the river and the fish. And then there's man versus his own nature in this, in Paul's rough and tumble life. And so I'm curious, you know, where does a book like this maybe fit in with a book like Wild, where it is about people finding themselves or finding truth in and around this, you know, this world that is bigger than they are, of nature?
Well, I think a big difference is that there's a sense. I don't want to comment too much on an article about Cheryl Strayed that I haven't read, but it seems to me like what people, I mean, she enters nature in a very conscious way. It's a different approach. Like, they're entering nature in this story to pursue an activity, a fishing, mm-hmm. you know, a fishing trip, and then the fact that it has these healing powers in his life is something that he has discovered by accident, you know, or that has arisen yeah. out of a tradition or a habit that he and his brother had, this hobby. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Cheryl Strayed's book, she's actively entering a ritual of a hike to get over some things in her life. You know, most recently a divorce for her, but also her mother's death, which had happened years before, and drug addiction and all sorts of things leading up to a hike. So she's creating a ritual in nature as opposed to these guys finding a ritual out of a tradition that already existed. That's one big difference. That's a great point.
I think that, I don't know. It sounds like that article is making nature too precious. And I mean, I love being outdoors and doing things in nature. I consider myself a nature lover. And my sister works for Greenpeace. It's part of my life.
Those terrorists?
But I think that we have to acknowledge that nature isn't necessarily a nature preserve, that every time a human interacts with an environment, indoors, outdoors, whatever, that's a part of the human experience. So, you know, fly fishing is a sport. Mm-hmm. Fish get killed. Mm-hmm. You know, that's it's not a pure description of how fish, you know, move through the water, and it's therefore absolutely valid to write about whatever your interaction with nature is. I mean, I'm sure a lot of the best nature writing doesn't occur in nature writing.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? I made little quotes with my fingers, listeners. So how I've been thinking about this recently, so it's summertime and I live on the East Coast. So I went to the beach by myself a couple weeks ago. And I spent the whole day lying on the sand and getting in the water, lying on the sand, getting in the water.
Perfect.
And that is a nature activity.
Yeah.
That is American. That is probably the most common American experience of nature is swimming.
Right.
But we don't think of it that way. And if you, you know, to get really environmental, you know, if you want to save the oceans, you have to remind people that so many of the things that we love doing are interactions with nature that are very delicate and that could go away. So, you know, Wild is a great example of that. This book is a great example of that. But, you know, every time you enjoy a forest or whatever, Bridge to Terabithia, every time your childhood best friend dies in a forest, you are experiencing nature. And so, yeah, I mean, not all nature writing can be, you know, a pure description. There can be narrative within nature. Mm-hmm. That's how I feel.
That makes good sense. All right. I accept your answers. Please close your blue books and submit them now. I litter, though, because it's good for the economy. It creates jobs. Someone's going to go pick that stuff up.
Great.
That was actually my wife's grandfather's theory.
Are you
Did
serious?
Did he really say that?
Yep. Creates jobs.
Wow.
And that's it for this episode of Literary Disco. Join us in 2 weeks when guest author Jim Gavis has us read The Woman Chaser by Charles Williford. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/literarydisco. Follow us on Twitter, @literarydisco. And check out our Goodreads page where discussion about Finnegan's Wake is ongoing. Thanks for listening. So crazy.